Through the last four decades, New Letters on the Air has tried to capture the essence of the creative impulse and give insight into life and literature, a notion summed up well by poet Nikki Giovanni.
Where do you enter a poem? At the same place I enter you, with balance and trust, with a jazzy sense of adventure. Painting outside the lines, wearing clothes cut against the bias, with spices among the flowers. A poem unfolds like a baby bat testing her wings, or a kitten taking her first steps, or a good dog moving arthritic limbs toward the door. There is sadness as well as loss and the promise of love. We begin a poem with a longing and end with a responsibility, and laugh all through the storms that are bound to come.
That's from Nikki Giovanni's Where Do You Enter in her book of love poems called Bicycles. It came out in 2010, the year our assistant producer Jamie Walsh began her journey with New Letters on the Air as an intern. Stay with us for a few of her favorites from the past decade, including Booker Prize-winning Australian writer Thomas Keneally, inspirational poet Ellen Bass, and two very different Missouri novelists, Daniel Woodrell and Alex George. Stay with us as we look behind the scenes of the radio show that's been produced by New Letters Magazine at the University of Missouri, Kansas City since 1977. I'm Angela Elam, and here's Jamie Walsh to introduce the young poet whose first book, Maybe the Saddest Thing, won the 2011 National Poetry Series Prize.
Marcus Wicker, when he came to town, I remember I was really struck with his poetry because he weaves so much pop culture into it, which I think is not something that a lot of people would expect, especially if you don't, like myself, I don't really come from a literary background. I studied media and communications and journalism, but not really English and literature. So the way that he brings people into it, weaving in pop culture characters and hip hop, it makes it more approachable.
And I love the fact that he has a musical background, and we'll actually get to hear some music that was recorded by his brother.
Yeah, that was another one of my favorite things about the show. Sometimes you get kind of stymied in by the production music that's okay for broadcast. So this was an instance where we got to use something different because it was music that his brother had produced. And also when I'm picking out music, I'm always looking for something that sounds like the feel of the reading that really keeps you in that space and makes you feel what they're feeling. So when they send in their own music, it's a lot easier to do that.
Well, let's listen to a little bit of that 2017 interview with Marcus Wicker and how he first came to poetry.
I think it was the Poetry Slam. It was a thing that happened a little later for me, I think, than others. But I was interested in other things. I was an amateur martial artist and a baseball player, and the words came a little later.
And it seems, too, that you've come to the words through sound, because the Poetry Slam, obviously, that's hearing the poetry. But it's also very obvious that music is a huge part of your life, too. There's a whole section of Maybe the Saddest Thing called Beats, Breaks, and B-Sides.
Right.
I read that your brother was a record producer. Is he still doing that?
He is, yeah. He's a hip-hop producer. He's produced for Lil Wayne and Rick Ross.
Wow.
Lots of folks. He's in a group called The Olympics with a K. My parents put us through music lessons all through school.
Okay.
I played tenor sax, he played alto, and he took piano lessons.
You have a couple of different Ars Poetica. This is the first one from Maybe the Saddest Thing, and it's Ars Poetica in the mode of J-Live. How would you explain this to your hip-hop audience?
Well, I'd explain it the same way, I think, to any audience, just saying that an Ars Poetica is a poem on the art of poetry. It's like this, Anna. Shell bang bear with a bat, Anna. Vat of gunpowder shed and a famished bird fed off scraps, Anna. Gut itch flown south for life, Anna. Dropper stool self-peck slow, Anna. Wince or stool dropped again, Anna. Bird sifting through his shit, Anna. Slug built by a bird's beak and a small handgun. It's like this, Anna. Like a gun the bird doesn't grip. It's like this, Anna. It's like that. It's like that and like this.
Ars Poetica in the Mode of J-Live by Marcus Wicker from his book, Maybe the Saddest Thing. So who do we have next?
I picked out Thomas Keneally, who wrote Schindler's Ark, which later became the movie Schindler's List. And I remember when he came to town, he was just so delightful, which I think is why I like his show because he covered such heavy material in Schindler's Ark. And then in this interview, he was talking about the Daughters of Mars, which is about nurses in World War I. So it was all this really heavy material, but he just was so joyful the whole time. And I just loved it.
So you have an excerpt from this 2013 interview with the Australian novelist talking about his book that ultimately became the famous film, Schindler's List.
I was delighted that the film did bring it to so many people because the primary and more important source in the writer's mind is always the original work. So if the film made more people read it, all the better. And the Soviet Union had just fallen apart when the film emerged. The griefs and bloody antagonisms of the Baltic states had not emerged at that stage. And there was a great deal of hope that at last we had learned from the follies of ethnic hysteria in the past. And the Schindler book was, to an extent, being greeted as one of the swallows of that spring, and thus very exciting to be associated with.
It's a novel, but so many of the stories within the novel were true stories. Can you talk about writing a novel that is so based on reality?
Well, Truman Capote showed me the way within Cold Blood. And I wanted to write it in the spirit of Truman Capote's work. I thought it was the best way to do it. And both the primary contact, Leopold Pfefferberg, and myself were scared that it would end up lost in the, with all due respect to the writers of Judaica, that it would end up in the Judaica section. Leopold Pfefferberg always said, it's good that you're an Australian, it's good that you're a Gentile. This is a book for Gentiles. And he wanted it in the areas where Gentiles buy books. It's funny, sometimes the film, and by indirection the book, is said to be the catalyst for people beginning to speak up about their Holocaust past. For me, a humiliating number of the children of Holocaust survivors thanked me for writing it and Spielberg for making the film and creating the Shoah Foundation because it made their parents speak.
That was Thomas Keneally, the author of Schindler's Ark, which ultimately became Schindler's List. And you're listening to New Letters on the Air, favorites of our assistant producer, Jamie Walsh. I'm Angela Elam, and we just thought we'd share some moments behind the scenes with New Letters on the Air. Okay, next we have another poet, Ellen Bass.
She was really fascinating to me. She talks about in this program putting together this anthology of women writers, and she talks about some of her mentors, Anne Sexton, and then working with Florence Howe specifically to put this anthology of women writers together. And it really touched me because she's talking about preserving this work and making sure that it's not lost. And that's obviously something working here that's really important to me. And even now, as we might be going away, it's still important to me to preserve all of the audio, not only for the authors that are in it, but also to preserve the work of all the people who've worked on this show before me since it started in 1977, everybody who's really dedicated their time and their lives to it. So that idea of really committing yourself to preserving work and keeping it going is just so important to me.
Okay, here's Ellen Bass in 2017 talking about her mentor, Florence Howe, and the influence of working with her on a groundbreaking anthology called No More Mask.
Florence is somebody who is known very much in academic circles, but not so much outside. She is co-founder of the Feminist Press, which is the oldest running women's press in the world. Also, Florence knew every woman writer and brought some of them back out of obscurity. One of the early missions of the press was to re-find works that were classic works that had gone out of print that were going to be lost to us and to publish them again. So Tilly Olson, Grace Paley, The Yellow Wallpaper, Charlotte Perkins Gilman. I mean, they did amazing work and continued to do amazing work. In the last, I guess, decade or so, they've published these monumental volumes of women writing Africa, women writing Asia, going with scholars from all over the continent of Africa and all over India, finding works that had never been translated into English, and some of them that had never been even published. So just bringing women's literature, making it available and making it permanently in the covers of books so that it won't get lost again has been a huge thing. And Florence really, I would say if you're going to name one person who is why we have the whole discipline of women's studies in colleges and universities across the world, it's Florence, but most people don't know that.
Wow.
Yes. And she was my teacher at Goucher College.
And that's where you went for undergraduate school.
That's where I went for
school.
Undergraduate.
Oh, so that preceded
that
your
preceded.
Time with Anne Sexton.
It did. Florence was my first mentor, and we went on to have close association. She had this pilot project in which Goucher students taught poetry to vocational students in high school. I was teaching auto mechanics. All the things that I learned from her when we were teaching those students are the same things that I have used and adapted through my entire 50 years of teaching writing, of this deep respect for the student, this open dialogue, a quality of paying attention and listening rather than thinking that you know everything, and a collaborative approach that is really just so basic, but was revolutionary at the time. So Florence, shortly after I graduated college, I was at BU studying with Anne, and that semester was coming to a close, and she came to visit me. I was living in Cambridge, and she thought that I was depressed, and she had recently lost someone to depression. Florence's cure for anything is work. And she told me this many years later that she decided she had to cook up a project for us because if I was depressed, I needed to work. And so she suggested that we do this anthology together. And at first, we couldn't even conceive of an anthology of poems solely by women. We thought we would collect poems about women by both men and women. And after a few months, it became clear that the plethora of poems was overwhelming. And also, we had no time frame. It was going to be, you know, from the Greeks forward. And so it became clear, oh, no, we have to narrow this down. And that's how we wound up having an anthology of poems by women. We said, okay, it will just be 20th century. It will just be American. We made one exception for Margaret Atwood. And it will just be poems by women. And that's how the anthology got framed. And we worked on that for several delicious years together. And I was just a pig in mud because, you know, I was just a kid. Her sense of respect and democratic ways of doing things, she allowed me to not just kind of be her gopher, but really allowed me in on all the decision making and took me on as a full co-editor.
Wow, what a great experience and what a wonderful thing for a poet to do all that reading of
yes.
other poets.
Oh my God, that came out in 1973. So at that time, I read, because it was possible to read, every single poem that was published in a book by a woman in America.
Wow.
And some that weren't published. And of course, no one could do that today.
Ellen Bass. She talked about No More Mask, an anthology of 20th century American women poets that she worked on with Florence Howe, her mentor. Ellen Bass now leads poetry workshops around the country. She's very, very active out there. And so you can see this very young,
moment in her education completely influenced the rest of her life. I love that.
Yeah.
You know, it's interesting. All the people you picked are delightful people. That's a word I would use for every one of these people that are in the show today.
I would say most of the people who have come here have just been so great. They're so giving with their craft, and they're willing to talk about it and advise people. A lot of them are professors and are teaching students and are trying to give back in that way and to just bring people into the literary community, which is something, like I said before, I didn't study literature or creative writing. I was definitely on the outside of it. And being able to sit here on all these conversations, I've learned so much, not only about writing, but also the subjects that people are writing about. People are writing about music, they're writing about art, they're writing about history. It's been such a great opportunity to learn from people about writing and just about the world and about how we tell and share stories.
Sometimes people forget that poetry and creative fiction allow you into a world that you won't get from just listening to news stories. So, well, next up, I'm so glad you picked Daniel Woodrell because he's probably one of the most important Missouri novelists around. And he's from West Plains, Missouri, as they call it. So he brings the Ozarkian countryside to life. People who don't read novels might know him from Winter's Bone, which was made into a film, and before that, Ride with the Devil, based on one of his novels as well. So tell me why you chose Daniel Woodrell.
He's another person, the same way that Thomas Keneally, I think, is delightful. Like, they've both had their books made into very popular, well-known movies, and Daniel Woodrell is still so down to earth. And the way that he talks about making his characters, he talks to people in his everyday life to sort of get inspiration, to make sure that his characters are these three-dimensional people, not just like this is the villain and this is the hero. So I really loved that. And I also really love that he seems to care for people around him the way that he wants to hear people's stories. He wants to hear everyone's stories.
I was often drawn to write about people who almost nobody would volunteer to spend time with and try to draw them well enough that you at least had a recognition that they were human, if nothing else, and that was what I felt my urge to write was. And it's changed a little bit over the years, but that's still pretty much in there.
Yeah.
I'm trying to think if I've ever known anybody well that didn't turn out to have an interesting story behind them, or interesting qualities that made you speculate about other aspects of their life that you weren't really privy to. Almost everybody seems to me pretty darned interesting if you get some actual details and background from them. So I always approached every character as if there's going to be something in there worth going after.
People who are criminals, meth heads, or small-time petty thieves, alcoholics.
Yeah, I've always, so far, covered that kind of character quite a bit. And I had the benefit as a kid of knowing a number of guys who were born into that life. So it was never an exotic, bizarre thing to me. It was always something that I'd seen in my own life already. We did not participate in it. My dad didn't. My mom didn't. She might shoot you, but it wouldn't be as part of a career pattern. But, but I did know him from grade school on up a little bit. And eventually when I began to be a writer, I realized, look, just people and their lives bent certain ways. And so I always wanted to be alert to the humanity and involved in all these lives and ways of life.
When you're writing, how do you go about organizing your writing? I mean, do you write scenes and shuffle them around ever?
Yeah, I often have to do that. The order they come out in, it ends up not really being a way that'll carry it forward. And so you do have to reshuffle them. Most of it's by feel. I'll sense that something needs to go here or there or needs to be written here or there. But I don't plan anything out very far in advance. Even in this book, I wasn't really sure how it was going to end. So I usually don't know that. About halfway through or two-thirds, I usually start having a strong idea of where a book's going. But
wow, so you don't plot it out at all.
No.
Maybe that's part of the reason why you enjoy writing.
It is. It's fun for me that way. And I did early in my career try to outline, but it just was pointless exercise, really, because all it guaranteed is not going to be much like the outline.
You're a renegade at heart.
Well, but you start actually doing the writing, and it's just not going that direction. You know, the character is taking on some qualities that you hadn't predicted, and the thing is kind of bending another way.
Gosh, they're like human beings.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Unpredictable in that way.
Yeah, that's part of the fun for me.
Daniel Woodrell in 2013, just after his novel The Maid's Version was released. You know, one of the things that's really fun about Daniel Woodrell is that we have several shows with him. He was interviewed by a couple of other people besides myself. And so it's nice to be able to trace the career of writers. That's the thing that we're so proud of in our archives of New Letters on the Air, is just that we get to hear writers at different points in their trajectory as creative writers and, you know, kind of follow how they develop over the years. It's
yeah,
a great
there's
thing.
There's a lot of people who have had multiple shows, and it was Margot Livesey who compared coming back here every few years to coming to Delphi. That's my favorite thing.
I love that. It's a bit of hyperbole, but I'll take it.
I also wanted to say about Daniel Woodrell, the other reason I really like that clip is that it's so fascinating that he doesn't plot things out. The story just sort of exists somewhere in the ether, and he's just finding it as he goes. Like, I'm a very organized person. Like, I like to have a plan and get things marked out and have a schedule. And I just don't know if I could just start writing something and just be like, well, we'll see where this goes.
If I've learned anything in this nearly 25 years of producing this show, it's that there's no one way. That's what's ultimately fascinating to me every time I sit down with someone, is you never know how it is that they work. Okay, we're going to hear next from Alex George, who lives in Missouri but is originally from England. This was a few years back as well, and he had just come out with his novel, A Good American. Tell me why you chose Alex George.
This is a show that has always stuck out to me. His readings in this show are so great, but also he's talking about the immigrant experience in a different way. These immigrants are coming from Germany. They're not coming through Ellis Island. They're coming up through New Orleans and traveling through Missouri. And then Alex has his own immigrant story, being from England and then becoming a U.S. citizen and living and teaching in Missouri. So it's all just so interesting to me. It was one of the first shows that I worked on when I came to work here, and it stuck with me this whole time.
They always say, write what you know. And I think write what you know is a good theory, as long as you actually know something that's worth writing about. And then it struck me that the experience of moving my life to a new country, 4,000 miles away from my home and my family and my friends, with no expectation that I would ever return, might actually qualify as being something that was worth writing about. That was where the idea of writing about immigration came from. And my family has form when it comes to this sort of stuff, because my mother was a New Zealander. She was born and raised there. And she came to England in the early 60s, met my father, and never went back. And in fact, her great-grandparents made the trip in the opposite direction from England to New Zealand.
I read that. In what, the 1860s?
Something like that. Yeah. So there's a lot of history of this sort of thing in my family. But when I thought about it, it occurred to me that although in some ways my journey to Missouri in 2003 couldn't have been much more different from what my great-great-grandparents went through, there are certain things that are probably very similar, and certain emotions that everybody feels, and whether that's the hope for a new life or fear for the unknown. And there's also this paradox, which I try and explore in the book, between wanting to fit in to your new home but not ever forgetting where it is that you came from. My mother just celebrated her 50th anniversary of her arrival in England. But she still calls New Zealand home.
Even 50 years later.
Yeah.
I love that, you know, you should write this book that happens to be titled A Good American, because I know you worked on this book for a while before you were able to come up with the title.
The title was not my idea at all. I wish I could take credit for it, because I think
it was your editor?
Yes, it was.
Yeah.
Very early on in the book, there's a conversation just after Frederick and Yetta have arrived in St. Louis. A friendly Pole, an immigrant himself, helps them. And just before they set off, he exhorts Frederick to be a good American And my editor found that line, and it's a great title. I think it's memorable. It's a little bit provocative, and I'm very pleased with it. I just wish I could take some credit for it.
Actually, you know, that passage that you just mentioned, I had marked it because it's also very humorous. Frederick is out in the middle of the street saying, "I need to hire a carriage for a long journey." He thought he was learning English, and he took all these lessons from this barkeep. I thought I'd get you to start with that line.
"I need to hire a carriage for a long journey," he shouted. His words rose into the air unheeded. The only discernible effect of the outburst was to create an island in the ebb and flow of traffic as people shifted direction to avoid him. Frederick clenched his fists into fat knots of distress and shook them at the sky. "Excuse me." A man in an immaculate three-piece suit was standing in front of him. He looked about 60 years old. He had spoken in perfect German. Frederick dropped his arms to his side in surprise. "Yes? Can I help you?" Frederick took a deep breath. "I need to hire a carriage for a long journey," he said in English. "A carriage, yes, I see," replied the man, again in German. Frederick gave up. "Meine Frau ist ziemlich krank." My wife is ill. The familiar sound of the words made him want to weep. "Ill?" said the man. "She is expecting a baby. She has a fever." The man took off his glasses. "I am a doctor. May I see her?" "Of course, if it's not too much trouble." "Not at all." He put out his hand toward Frederick. "My name is Joseph Wall." Frederick shook his hand. "How could you tell I was German?" "Oh, I studied there for a while in Königsberg. I recognized your accent." "I've only just begun to learn your language," Frederick said. "It's difficult." Joseph Wall nodded. "It certainly is." "You're the first person who has offered to help," said Frederick, unable to hide his bitterness. "Well, what do you expect?" Frederick frowned. "What do you mean? You do know where you are, I presume." "Of course, this is St. Louis, Missouri, the United States of America." "Well, that's right. So why were you standing in the middle of the street, shouting in Polish?"
A Good American, the novel by Alex George, would make a great movie. They come into the port in New Orleans, and he has this introduction to jazz music and then makes their way up to St. Louis. It's very cinematic when you read it. Well, we are going to finish off the way we began, with a poem by Nikki Giovanni. Why did you choose this?
Her sense of storytelling, all the stories that she tells in that show, she talks about her mom, she talks about going to the CIA.
And we're not talking Culinary Institute of America.
She talks about drinking beer and just her whole sense of storytelling. And then I think there's a lot of love in the way that she delivers her writing.
"I loved before I understood love is a skill. I love my mother's cool hands on my forehead. I loved the safety of her arms. I trusted before I understood the word. Mommy would say when I had fallen, 'Come here, Nikki, and I'll pick you up.' And I would wipe my eyes, push myself off my fat bottom, and toddle over to her for my reward, a kiss, and a 'That's my big girl.' I'm still a sucker for that one. But I grew up and learned trust and love are crafts we practice, or wheels we balance our lives on, are bicycles we ride through challenges and changes to escape and ecstasy."
Nikki Giovanni's title poem from her book Bicycles, Love Poems. To hear the complete shows with all of the writers featured in today's favorites, visit our website, newletters.org. But hurry, changes are afoot. If you want to help keep New Letters on the air on your radio or in your podcast lineup, please email radio@newletters.org. A special thanks to assistant producer Jamie Walsh and to you for listening. I'm Angela Elam for New Letters on the Air.